Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Matt Letissier was the ultimate local hero. Great film, by the way. Thank you for calling Knox Island Gas. Matt loved that rabbit. It had a name. It had two names. Okay, enough. Simply exquisite talent. Matt could have played for any team in England, really, truthfully, for any team in Europe, but instead opted to stay at Southampton during his whole career. Why? Well, listen to part one and part two, which comes next Monday, and you'll find out. In the first part, Matt explains his Enid Blyton-esque childhood on Guernsey, how much it formed him and shaped his attitudes for the rest of his life, his passion for cricket, the art of penalty taking, and that moment when, almost as if it was scripted, he scored the last ever goal at the Dell before Southampton moved to St Mary's. This episode was made possible by Nordoff Robbins. We met Matt on a glorious afternoon in London before the Nordoff Robbins annual football fundraising dinner in London. It's a charity that all of us at the Big Interview would like you to think about. Nordoff Robbins delivers music therapy to change the lives, to change the experience of vulnerable children and adults across the UK. As always, this Big Interview podcast is free. But if you think that this chat is worth a pound or more, please do go to www.nordoff-robbins.org.uk, then hit donate. For the moment, just luxuriate in Matt Letissier, sensational footballer, substantial, warm, interesting man. Enjoy.
I suppose I start the same way all the time because this is what it makes me sincerely feel. It's a privilege to meet you and to be able to chat soccer with you.
Thank you.
Matthew Letissier, because you had gifts that so few people in football over my entire lifetime possessed and used them brilliantly. We're here in the Grosvenor House Hotel. You can explain how you did it all. One of the things that stands out to me that I want to ask you about is football for the pure joy of playing it, inventing things. Football for the pure joy of making people happy and a spectacle. I think that was part of your attitude to the sport over your career. True? And did it help you?
Yeah, 100%. 100% true. I always knew that I was given a gift, that I could play football pretty well. And I always knew I wanted it to be my job. But I knew it was an entertainment industry. And for me, going out and trying things, trying different things that other people couldn't do, that weren't brave enough to try and do, was one of the things that gave me the buzz about going out on a match day and doing things that would make an entire stadium get on their feet and give you a round of applause. It was just the most fantastic feeling for me to see it kind of a stadium erupt just because of something that I've just done with the football.
One of the things that makes us feel satisfied about choice of guest is when so many of our guests use phrases that have come up before in the interviews without me having to prompt them, and bravery is one, because I've always been entranced by the idea that amongst British footballers, we've always had a certain sense of bravery that would be about against the odds or physicality. Mm. Or in the old days, I don't know if you remember, maybe Liverpool going and playing away and dominating Europe, but Sui having to knock somebody's jaw out of the socket. But you're talking about an entirely different type of bravery, risk-taking, creativity, trying something, showing for the ball when you're not sure if you're in form or you're not sure if someone's going to clog you from back and ruin your Achilles. talk to me about why did you use that word bravery, and did you feel the risk or did it stimulate you?
The risk stimulated me. I liked being that person that will take a chance, being that person that will do something a little bit different that will make him stand out from all the other people. That was kind of one of the things about football that I loved, and it was one of the things really that I've got my youth team manager at Southampton, Dave Merrington, I have a lot to thank him for, because he saw that in me and he didn't try knocking it out of me. He could see what I could do with the ball, he saw what I could do in training, and he didn't shackle me in any way when I was in the youth team at Southampton to try and knock that out of me, and I'll be eternally grateful to him for that, because it meant that I could grow and not play football with any fear. And that was kind of one of my biggest strong points in my career, I think.
Because football is a fearful industry, right?
It's a fearful industry because people are fearful of losing. But I think sometimes in the midst of it all, I think people somewhere along the line have forgotten that people pay good money to come and watch the game. And for me, it's an entertainment industry and people want to go away feeling good, that they've seen something that's kind of made them feel joyous. And yes, that is their team winning, but it goes a little bit deeper than that.
Or even drained. If you've been exuberant and you haven't won, but you've come close, or you want the full gamut of human emotions.
Absolutely, the full gamut of emotions is exactly right. And I mean, even now, I go and watch Southampton play, and there are games when I come away and I think I've actually played in the game because I'm like drained at the end of it.
Really? You still get the adrenaline of whoa. So you get the adrenaline of a fan who's never had your talent or your life. You don't view it differently because you've succeeded and been, elite. You still feel like the ordinary fan.
I view it differently when I'm watching a game of football that doesn't involve my team. So when I'm watching a game on Soccer Saturday, I view it not from the side of just
analytically
looking at one team. Yeah, so I look at it from a very neutral point of view, and I can kind of judge how both teams have played, whether one team maybe deserves to win more than another team. When I'm watching Southampton, it tends to kind of go out the window. That's probably one of the reasons why we're not allowed to watch our own team on Soccer Saturday anymore. But when I go to St Mary's and I'm watching a game, I'm fully involved in it. And when a goal is going to be scored, I kind of see things in a game, and I know when it's going to be a really good chance, and I know kind of when it's going to be a goal. And I often find myself being the first one, and I'm normally in the director's box at Southampton now, I'm normally the first one out my seat.
On your feet, because you've known.
Because I know it's coming.
That's wonderful.
And I'm the one that stood there just waiting to go. And I just get involved in it. I love it.
I'm in a habit of just asking what I'm curious about. She said you were given a gift. So before we go into sort of theology or religion or anything like that, if I asked you how far would you have got in your life with just your natural talent, would I be right in speculating that not as far? Because I have the inkling that all great players of your talent, almost all of them, have practiced to a huge degree at some stage in their life. And I don't really mean training sessions.
No, I you're absolutely right. I practice as a kid. I can just remember having a football at my feet a lot of the time. A lot of the time. I mean, when the summer months came round, I was playing cricket and it was a cricket ball for the whole of the summer. But during the football season, I played a lot with my friends around the estate that I lived on. If there was nobody around, I'd create little games for myself.
You had to have an imagination about like where the goal might be.
So I had at my house, just outside my front door, I had an area where I could throw a tennis ball against the wall, and I would come back off the wall and I'd chest and volley it against the back of the shed of next door's house. So it was, we lived in a terrace house and the back of their shed backed onto our front patio. So I can remember it in detail now. There was like a couple of lines, it was split into thirds. The back of the shed had a line down and a line down, so there was three parts, and I'd throw the ball up and I'd make sure that it never went in the middle one, because that's where the goalkeeper was stood. And it was always, I'd go for the bottom corners each time.
And you'd be challenging yourself to make sure you did it.
Absolutely. So I would stand there. I can remember playing games like, right, I'm going to throw 10 balls against that wall and I'm going to chest and volley it. And if I get 9 out of 10 in those two side thirds, I'm going to be a professional footballer. And that's the game that I'd play with myself. And just little things like that, really. Just invent games.
When recently making a film, I had a great privilege of speaking to Andres Iniesta again, and I asked him about, if you remember the goal in 2009 at Stamford Bridge, where the first leg, Chelsea against Barcelona, has been 0-0. And Essien has scored for Chelsea, and to the last seconds, with Hiddink in charge of Chelsea, it's been Chelsea in the final in Rome. And the ball comes to the back edge of the Chelsea box, and instead of dribbling, Messi lays a nice carpet ball pass to Iniesta, and he shoots and scores and beats Cech in the top corner. I mistakenly thought great players have got this computer sort of Mission Impossible brain assessing space and trajectory and all that. And he went, I didn't think about anything. The ball came to me, I knew I had to score, and I just kicked it. And he explained it, that when you work as hard as they do on their skills, it's just automatic. Mm. To what extent does that apply to the special things you could do with the ball?
Yeah, I think there are times in football matches where I did things which were completely and utterly automatic. And I actually, to the point of sometimes I would do something in the game and it would be televised and I'd have to go back and watch the game to work out how I'd got the other side of the defender. Because in the moment, I'd done something and I got the other side of him and I didn't really know what I'd done. And so I'd watch it back on the TV and go, okay, that's how I did it. I shifted the ball there and there and I went. But in the moment, it happens so quickly and you just do it automatically. You just don't think about it.
See, one of the things in preparing for this, one of the things that, I'm not being rude to other people, but I found cliched and boring, was a lot of talk and obsession about whether during your career you were, you know, an Olympic athlete or not. I look at, I've met Zidane, I've met Valeron. I don't know how much you were able to watch Valeron.
Yeah, not a lot.
I meet you now, watched you during your career, and physically your size in terms of height and broadness of shoulders and whatever links you a lot, and I think that it's obviously a great advantage because it's a very physical sport, which I think most spectators and probably most journalists don't understand, that it's a very physical sport.
Yeah.
But your balance and the things you've just been talking about doing, that's not all what you did with your feet. Movement and being able to judge space and when to turn somebody, or if you're dribbling, you need enormous physical coordination, self-confidence, that, again, a lot of footballers, in my view, don't have.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong about this.
No, I've always found that I was able to... my balance was always very good, but not just that, I was able to feel where my defenders of their body weight was.
Body weight meaning centre of gravity?
So their centre of gravity to know which way they could turn quickly and which way they can't turn quickly.
How did that come to you? Have you never analysed it ever?
No, not really. I couldn't even to this day. I'm thinking about it now and I can picture myself lining up a defender one-on-one and using my body to get him to shift his body weight. But yes, I know where I'm going. And once his body weight shifted and I go the other way, I just know that kind of if I do something, he's going to react to it. But I know once I've done it and he's reacted, I'm off. Because I wasn't the quickest, I guess I had to hone that skill better than most people.
Yes.
To be able to get me away from people.
You see, because you didn't watch yourself, apart from when you're watching back on TV, you may be unaware, because everybody talks about the jouissance moment, about like the flick or the power or the distance or the pass, and you go to the tip of the iceberg. What I always really enjoyed was the elegance, whether something came off or not, whether it went in the goal. I liked, you're selling a proposition. It's almost like a magician with sleight of hand. You're like, here, look at this, and now I've done a trick here. And I think that's a priceless gift.
I think that was kind of one of the things that I was able to do probably better than most people, because a lot of people who had pace kind of didn't really need to hone that skill, because they just knock the ball past them and just go. And I didn't have that, so I had to find a different way of getting past people. And that was kind of one of the things that helped me with that also was what I did practice a lot as a kid was working on my first touch. And when the ball came to me, I knew 98 times out of 100 my first touch, I could put that ball wherever I wanted it to go to give me the best chance of beating a defender, making a pass, giving myself space. And kind of that first touch allied with the kind of ability to be able to move people's body weight and shift their centre of gravity was kind of the thing that kind of stood me apart a little bit, I think.
We're talking about innate ability and things you worked on to complement that. One of the, well, probably you permitting, speak a lot about Glenn Hoddle, about whom I've got, I'll be open, very mixed views. But if you grew up idolising him as a sportsman, as a footballer, and Neil snorted at me when we shared this story because he says everybody, and it is true, I've interviewed Leo Messi and I heard him say, better players than me, and they dropped out. So it's a repetitive story, but there was a better player than me. Every generation, every club, every country said, and apparently, one of your brothers, I think, Carl, you've said, right, better than me. So let's
I don't know if I ever admitted to him before.
Ah, okay, sorry. Carl,
I think what I said was
he was shaking
equally,
his head as soon as I mentioned
his
name.
Good.
but so
I had
in other
two
words,
brothers who should have been professional.
Who were excellent. But you weren't the fully formed Matthew Letizia aged 8, 9, 10, 11, talented, but not like you are. So to what extent, watching Hoddle doing the things you've just been talking about himself, did that add to your vision or your confidence or your, yes, I can do that because my idol does it?
Very much so. Very much so. Obviously, back in the days when I was growing up, we didn't see every team every weekend on the TV. So you would only get little glimpses of it. But, you know, when Spurs were the team that were on Match of the Day that evening, you know, I was glued to the telly and I literally would just watch him. Mm. And whenever he was involved in a move, I'd watch what he could do. And see the England games were on the TV when he was playing for England. And so all the long-range passing, the fact that he just made the game look so easy with his first touch, he kind of just, it was all almost mesmerising for me to watch him play football.
So you would soak it up. And as well as, because I don't think we're talking about something as simple as, I'm going to copy that, I'm wondering if it gave you licence to dare, to take risks, to be creative.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I watching him do things at that level and, you know, at even international level gave me the belief that he's doing it at that level, I can do it at the level I'm at and still be doing it when I get there. Yeah. And that was kind of a big deal for me to watch him. He had that fabulous season when I scored, you know, over 20 goals, and, you know, a lot of them were outside the box, curled into top corners, volleys from outside the box. It was just a stunning season for him.
And you didn't know it at the time, but he was training at Spurs exactly the way you were training in the terraced houses with the tennis ball and the goals, because at Spurs they had all the big concrete walls in the gym with a square and a triangle and hit there for points and take it, volley it, give it back. You were actually...
Yeah, you know, it's kind of one of those things you just do as a kid. You know, I loved football and I just wanted to get good at it and better at it. I knew I was good, but I wanted to get better.
So did England lose a very good wicketkeeper?
I was all right as a wicketkeeper.
No,
I was a better batsman.
I need more details. What you don't know is that the very first podcast that we did was Gary Neville, and we talked cricket because Richie Beno had just died, and we were both touched and affected by a truly great man, great cricketer, great captain, great commentator, great man. I think you could go so far as to say we were really moved by his departure. And we talked a little bit of cricket and some other ones, but we ended up with Phil Neville, who was facing West Indian pacemen in the Lancashire Semi-Pro League aged 10-11 at his mum and dad's insistence without a helmet.
Wow.
Otis Gibson, it was. And therefore, cricket is something I've always loved. So I'm interested, if you're a better batsman, I'd like to know about it. I remember that John Arlott, one of the great voices I grew up, ended up living down by you in the Channel Islands.
Yeah.
So from cricket, I want to know about Guernsey and growing up and what sport in the Channel Islands was like for you then. But tell me a bit about cricket.
I loved my cricket as well. Probably back in those days, it was probably only very close behind football.
Goodness me.
Yeah, very close. I had good eye coordination. I saw the ball really well when I batted. I think the wicket had been helped as well because I'd keep wicket. I was the captain of the team, so when we won the toss, I'd always field first so that I could keep wicket, and I'd get my eye in while I was keeping wicket and then go out and open the bat from ball one. My eye was in, and so I had some really good scores. I made my first century when I was 13 or 14, and I think my top score in a 2020 evening league game was about 164, I think.
Playing, I presume, with all different ages? And
well, I played Guernsey under-18s when I was 15, so I kind of grew up playing only a year or two around my age, but the batting side of things I found came quite easy to me. Ian Botham was my hero as a boy.
Uh-huh.
So Ian Botham was my Glenn Hoddle. That's how I wanted to bat.
I think if you talk about cricketers, for me, it'd be Viv, Derek Randall at the time.
Derek Randall was a brilliant fielder. Yeah, so
I couldn't believe what he could do with it. And also, like we started this chat, like wherever he went, he took his wicket, where he came up with the ball, and playing with a smile. I may be happy to watch him.
Yeah, very much so. Very. Like a comic book hero, Beefy was just incredible.
But then so are you, if you think about it. I mean, I grew up watching or reading Billy's Boots in whichever it was, Bean or that.
Yeah.
And Billy was at that stage. I just thought this was just like made up. It can't be true. It turns out that there were people all over the Big and Every podcast series who were doing the same. Because Phil was explained to us how he was captain of England schoolboys playing against Australia.
Yeah, it was
And he
amazing.
Had to choose between blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah, he was at a much higher level than I ever was.
Well, it doesn't sound like it. Did you have a choice at a stage? Personally, I don't mean...
If I got offered, obviously, an apprenticeship at Southampton when I was 16.
Yeah.
Had I not been offered an apprenticeship, or had, after my apprenticeship, I'd been released, my next attempt at a job would have been to have been a cricketer.
Hampshire?
Hampshire was my nearest county, so it would have been... I would have tried to have gone to...
And then the little time you have as a professional, who did you watch down at Hampshire that really struck you, that made
Robin
you...
Smith. Down at Hampshire, watching him, I think, was just another type of bravery, I suppose, watching Robin.
Because of the way he batted?
Because of the way he batted, he was kind of real, quite aggressive, quite swashbuckling, and, you know, he was a guy that would stand there, you know, watched him bat against the West Indian fast bowlers of that era, which were just, I dread to think what it was like facing those boys. But he was doing it, and he'd take them on, you know, yeah, just, I think watching Robin Smith square cut a ball off of a 90-mile-an-hour delivery was something.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Pretty special.
I'm speculating here, but having watched your enjoyment of the spotlight and your dealing with pressure, had you progressed your cricket? I think you'd have probably tried at least to treat the West Indian bowling in that manner.
Oh, I would have had a go, yeah, I would have had a go. That was kind of the way I was as a sportsman. Any kind of sport that I took on, I wanted to do it, but I wanted to do it in style. I didn't just want to be okay at it. I wanted to do something that people would go, oh, even now I can, you know, have a game of table tennis with my mates and we'd rally for a few shots and then I'd have to try the big top spin forehand and the flick and I just wanted to do everything with a bit of panache, really.
Life's for enjoying.
Absolutely.
If you can encapsulate a little bit about a childhood and a young adulthood spent on your island, what would people not realise that it was like, and why was it such a central part of your character?
I think probably what people wouldn't realise was probably the laid-back nature of growing up on an island like Guernsey. Mm-hmm. And it was very carefree. I think looking back now, I didn't realise how lucky I was to have grown up where I did. At the time, you kind of took it for granted because you didn't know any different.
No.
But from lads that I spoke to at my age who grew up in England, when I'm telling them what my childhood was like, they were going, what? Really? So, you know, you'd just be left, I'd be, you know, in the summer holidays, school summer holidays, you know, we'd be left to our own devices for the day. Mum and dad go off to work, spend the time on the beach, down the playing fields of a local school, and you kind of just knew when it was tea time, you just rocked back home at tea time. Mum and dad were never worried. You were always kind of there or thereabouts. I don't remember locking doors when we were kids. Your back door was always open. Even to this day, actually, I still see in Guernsey the honesty boxes on the side of the road, people selling things on the hedges outside their house, and they'll have the little tin that you stick the money in, and I just kind of don't see that very much over here anymore.
A sense of community would...
Oh, very much so. A very tight-knit community. Everybody knew everybody. I think I came from a big family, so I had three brothers, but I also... my mum came from a big family. My grandparents, who are still alive now, my granddad's 96 now, he had double digits siblings. My grand, who's 91, still going, she had double digit siblings. Mm-hmm. So there was always a massive sense of family around, you know, some fantastic Christmases spent with everybody at my grand's house, and everyone feeding there for my grand, who would turn up, and it was just a lovely way. My grand lived, so I lived on an estate. At the bottom of my estate was my school, mm-hmm. and the other side of my school was my grand's house. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of, I lived within about a 600-yard radius, and my local club, Vale Rec, who I played for, was probably about maybe a mile and a half from my house, and that was kind of where I lived.
When we were up meeting Phil Neville, one of the interviews that was going on at the same time was with Henry Winter and Nicky Butt. And Nicky recently, the interview came out with Nicky saying, listen, kids need to climb trees and fall out of them, and kids don't do what I did there, and it's changed everybody's outlook that they can't take risks, and everybody's cosseted, and they don't know how to deal with problems and whatever. Please, everybody else in my life does. Slap me when I'm being fanciful. But when you live a life like you've, an Enid Blyton childhood like you've just described, does it also give you an assuredness about taking risks? A feeling that life is a little bit about creativity and adventure?
Yeah, I think very much so. I think my parents also were obviously very supportive in what I was trying to do in the football field, but they were also kind of very supportive in terms of me being a bit different mm-hmm. when I was playing sports. And, you know, I try things on a football pitch, and I'd never once remember my mum or dad going, why didn't you pass to that guy there instead of trying dribbling past those three blokes? I never once had that from them. They kind of just let me go out and do what I was doing, and because I was enjoying it, I loved it. It was just fantastic, and they were always so supportive. And I also had aunties, uncles, grandparents who were also incredibly supportive.
Would they snip at you if you were sent off or booked for nipping at the referee? Is what I mean.
Yeah, I did get reprimanded on occasions by referees. My schoolmaster once had to take me back to my mum after one particular game when I wasn't particularly enamoured with the referee from the other school that we'd just played.
And you felt you'd been cheated, didn't you?
I knew we'd been cheated. And I was telling my mates about it as we were walking off the pitch, and it was just happened to be within earshot of my school teacher. He didn't like what I'd said about the opposing referee, so he thought that it was worthy of me being driven back to my house and him sitting me down in front of my mum and telling my mum what I'd just said about this teacher.
You... caused us to have, we've got a big audience, something like 3.5 million people have listened to us so far, but we've got a band of people who subscribe to us, and we said to them, would you like to send in some questions? We were deluged, like we've never been deluged before. There was one question which Neil tested me today, you won't have to guess about the one question, and we'll get to it hopefully in a slightly different way. But there was a really good one here from Gray Harding. And I'll read it out. He said, there are numerous occasions when Tis, if you don't mind, made the hair stand up on the back of my neck and caused such raw emotion that I wanted to burst into tears of joy. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to know is whether Matt had any stand-up moment of emotion whilst he was playing, or was it after scoring one of his worldly goals? The emotion of one of our many great escapes, assisting Franny Benali to score his one and only Saints goal, mm-hmm. and the one I want to focus on more than anything, scoring the final goal at the Dell. Mm. Now, it's your story, I'll let you tell it, but I've got a supplementary about that goal. First of all, I know I've jumped a huge amount, but we like to get the readers' questions in. The Dell is going to be no more. It's Arsenal last ever game. Set the scene if you don't mind.
Yeah, so that particular season, 2000-2001, I'd spent a lot of that season injured. You know, the season was drawing to a close. I think Arsenal had think they'd already won the title that year, or they'd come second in Manchester. We'd beaten Manchester United a couple of weeks before. United and Arsenal finished first and second, so Arsenal came to us on the last day of the season. I just managed to get myself free from injury. I'd been out quite a few weeks. The manager at the time, Stuart Gray, came to me on the Tuesday of the game, and he said to me, "You're going to be substitute on Saturday, and I guarantee you, for what you've done for this football club, I'm going to guarantee you that at the end of that game, you're going to be on the pitch, because you deserve to be." So that was on the Tuesday, and I went to bed every night that week knowing that I was going to be on the pitch and dreaming of scoring the last goal at the Dell.
This is what I was going to ask you then, because Gray wanted to know what stood out for you amongst all the memories, and I guess that must be there or thereabouts as the number one.
I think in terms of raw emotion, even when I talk about it now, I can feel myself getting a little bit choked up about it.
Good.
Because it was kind of, I think I just wanted, I felt like it was my destiny to score the last goal at that stadium after all that had done to kind of get us away from it.
It's a bit spooky. You're on the same wavelength as me. That's what I want to know about, because what correlation is there? So we're taking as read that this is a grown-up podcast and our audience is smart. You'd worked all your life for it. You're a very talented footballer. There were things about that goal which are natural because you'd worked for them and earned them. You're good at scoring. You handled pressure well. What correlation is there between dreaming about success, visualising success, getting yourself... Somehow, it's not quite what Gary Player and Jackie Stewart said about the more I practice, the luckier I get. It's not quite that.
No.
There's some sort of, or is there destiny?
No, I think there is a definite correlation. I think I think your mind is so powerful that I think if you think about doing something enough in your mind, when that moment comes in reality, you actually know how to deal with that because you've gone through it already 6 or 7 times in your mind before and you know what's happening. So when that situation arises, you don't freeze in the moment. It's almost like going into a kind of a state of just complete calmness and just letting everything flow. And I think that's kind of... I've heard golfers talk about it a little bit. When they're in the zone, they're in that moment where they're just kind of... The swing just flows and they don't feel pressure. They're just in that zone and everything just flows. And that was kind of what happened when that ball fell to me on the edge of the box. It wasn't an easy chance. If you put that... ball down there in training, you know, I might have knocked it in that top corner once or twice out of 10, maybe.
For those who haven't seen it, it's late, so the ball was crowded penalty area.
It was the 88th minute of the game, stood 2-2, and the ball got kind of flicked back behind me, so I was having to swivel with my weak foot, with my left foot, and it was on the half volley. And I've hit it sweet as anything and just flown into the top corner.
It's our podcast. I'm not accepting Matt's description of his left foot as my weak foot. I'm interjecting with non-preferred foot. I think the world would kill
for
having
that. Well, that was another thing, going back to Glenn Hoddle. I watched Glenn Hoddle play and he was hitting these passes with his right feet and his left feet and he just looked completely natural in both sides. And I wasn't very good with my left foot as a kid. And I worked, and it was remarked upon when I went to Oxford as a kid, about 13 or 14.
Right.
You didn't read my book properly, did you? So I went there as a
Toma,
kid.
Toma, in Spanish, that's Toma. There you go.
And the guy that put me up as my dad's friend in Oxford, he actually said to me, he watched me play, and he said, you need to work on your foot a little bit. So I thought, right, well, the best way of doing that is, for my next 3 games for my club and my school, I'm not going to kick the ball with my right foot. And I played 3 or 4 games only touching the ball with my left foot. And then I went out and practiced and it got...
See, there's a brave... Going
good,
back to a theme now, there's an element of risk there because maybe you were so good at playing off your left foot you're never going to be dropped. But you're already aware that while you're learning on your left foot at that stage, when you're younger and maybe criticism hurts more or teammates saying, what are you doing, hurts more. Practicing is an obvious thing, but practicing in a game, there's an element of bravery and risk to take that decision about how to benefit your less preferred foot.
Yeah, to a certain extent, although you know the standard of football in Guernsey wasn't that great.
You were high enough up there.
I was kind of high enough to be able to still affect a game by just playing with my left foot.
You talked about golfers there and being in the zone because they've visualised it, done it. And it's well established as part of sports science that there's muscle memory. Particularly, I think, for hand to ball. So is there a mental muscle memory? I think, in other words, you were talking about if your mind, your power of the mind that you talked about is a very arresting thing for me. And I'm going to ask you now as well whether you think that if that perhaps isn't one of the single most dominant flaws in English international football over recent years, because I've lived abroad and I see a different mentality like that in Germany and in Spain and in France. And what we're very good at is we've got an emotional power.
Yes.
Give us adversity, give us somebody we dislike, and we're ferocious lions. But that thing that you were talking about...
I believe that there is something mentally not quite as good with us as there is with other nations. And I think it's been kind of quite a while. And I think it goes along with the penalty shootout side of things as well. Mm-hmm. I think we've been affected mentally by the fact we've lost a couple early on when the penalty shootouts became kind of normal behaviour. And I think that's kind of got into people's psyche a little bit. And I think we do disregard that side of things a little bit sometimes. I think we neglect it a little bit. And I think Sam Allardyce was talking about perhaps getting somebody in to work on that side of things. So it's kind of starting to change a little bit, but it's making sure we've got the right people in, I guess, who are going to teach the right things to these people.
And at the right stage.
Mm-hmm.
The best.
Yeah, I think by the time you kind of get to international football, it's difficult to kind of give that to people.
Culturally,
at that age.
We should be teaching people at 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, little things like that.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. I think we're a little bit behind the eight ball in that respect. I think we've taken too long to grasp the nettle. We're looking at doing it at the top end instead of actually going, hang on a minute, if we start down here, we won't have to do it up there, because in 10 years' time, these lads have already got that.
If those who are going to win or not win tournaments for England over the next 10, 15, 20 years haven't been trained like that as kids, although maybe some aspect of the culture of football is changing with so many people having grown up watching Sky and being able to watch Spanish football and choose themselves, like you did watching Hoddle. Okay, I'm hearing what my coach says, I'm hearing what the school says, but that's what I want to be able to do. I'm very hopeful that you can seed that in a culture and eventually you get the flowers. First of all, if somebody asked you, would you go and help a squad, whether it be England or Southampton, deal with penalty taking as an art?
I was asked to go to Oxford at the start of last season. Dave Jones, who works at Sky, director at Oxford, was doing some stuff with them. They'd missed about three or four penalties during pre-season and I think the first game of the season. And he just asked me if I'd go down and have a chat with the lads and explain what was going through my head, what my technique was on the penalties. And so I said, yeah, no problem, I'm quite happy to do that. So I went down there. I had a chat with the boys down there this was on a Friday before they went to play away, so I can't remember where they're playing on the Saturday. So I went down, had a chat for about 15 minutes, took a few penalties, explaining what I was thinking, what my logic was as to how I took my penalties. So it was kind of, you know, my first thought was always to hit it into the keeper's left-hand corner as a right-footer, because there's a little bit of an arc on the ball because you're not striking it straight. The arc takes it away from the goalkeeper a little bit. If you go the other way, the angle's a little bit shallower, gives the keeper a bit more chance. So that was kind of where your starting point is. My second point then is I always keep my eye on the goalkeeper as long as I can. If I see him going towards that corner, because of my setup and because of the way my foot is when I'm going to hit the ball into that corner, if I see the goalkeeper, it's very easy. At the last minute, I just whip my foot around the ball and it takes it into the other corner. And so these are the things that I was kind of explaining to the Oxford boys. I said the one thing I never did was hit a penalty down the middle. But I don't agree with the penalties down the middle. You should be able to side foot a ball quite powerfully into either one of the corners, and that gives you the most chance to score a penalty. And that was how I left it. And I was watching soccer, I was on Soccer Saturday the following day, and it comes up from the Oxford game. I think it was Kemar Roof. Kemar Roof missed a penalty. I was like, oh no. I told Jeff that I'd gone to Oxford the day before as well and had a chat with the lads about the penalties. So he missed the penalty. So I was on the, when I got off the show, I rang up Dave Jones and I went, Dave, I said, what happened?
Come on.
He said, Matt, he said, I can't tell you how sorry I am. You were brilliant yesterday. Kemar Roof hit the penalty straight down the middle and the goalkeeper saved it. And I went, thank God for that. And it was like, so he didn't take the next penalty. Somebody else started taking the penalties and they scored a few doing the...
But you couldn't make this up, because football, I don't know if life is the same, ordinary working life is the same, but football is full of people who maybe are given like you said, I was given that, given some sort of ability, whether it's athletic or footballing or whatever, but don't listen or don't think or know better. the history of football is rife with that.
Yeah, and that's why when I get asked, I often get asked, you know, Dad will say to me, oh, young lad, you know, wants to be a footballer, what advice would you give him? And I always say to the kid, always listen to the people who have been where you want to go to. Mm-hmm. And that's the only advice I'll give them. And you're right, people just, they don't, they, I guess to a certain extent, I maybe have been like that when I was a kid. I kind of thought I knew better, a bit cocky, yeah, whatever, you're old now, I don't we're going to listen to you.
Fortunately, at that age, it turns out you did. I'm not being cheeky, but this podcast wouldn't be successful if I didn't give vent to my curiosity.
Yeah, of course.
You've described your penalty technique really well there, but I'm genuinely curious as if there was a psychological thing about the penalties for you too, because there's a really arresting phrase in your book, really arresting phrase about the adrenaline of and the sense of triumph in fighting relegation and winning.
Mm.
You have got very little problem with admitting that in penalties you savoured the spotlight and you wanted to be the hero.
I did.
And one, I think it's interesting, and two, I really like people hammer Cristiano Ronaldo all the time, and it drives me nuts. Because one of the things is that he's brave enough to say, I want the Ballon d'Or, I want to win the Champions League. And he says, I want to be regarded as the greatest footballer ever. And he probably doesn't deserve to achieve that, probably won't. But, boy, I love the fact that
she's
he's
got
like...
she's got to love the bullshit.
Here's what I'm after. This is what I'm after. Why should you be... But you genuinely, you know, like the attention and the focus and the scoring and the joy of being the hero.
I think the feeling when a penalty kick was given, especially at home, because obviously you then got 95% of the stadium that are going to go nuts if you score. So when the penalty was given, it was like butterflies would go in the stomach. It was like, oh, brilliant, this is my chance. You know, it's the easiest chance I'm going to get to score a goal all game. And then, as you say, the psychological part of things, the mental side of things for me was eradicating all negative thoughts out of your head. So I would then, once the penalty had been given, you get the butterflies, you get hold of the ball, put the ball down on the spot, and you kind of walk back, and I'm all the time just imagining the stadium just about to erupt and the joy on everyone's faces when this ball hits the back of the net. So as I step up to the penalty,
this is all in your mind, in mental pictures,
all this is going through my mind. Hmm. And it's all positive. Mm-hmm. Everything that's going through my head is all positive. And I think that's kind of the penalty that I missed, obviously, because I was so positive and because I just thought I was going to score every penalty I ever took. The penalty that was saved, that Mark Crosley saved, the rebound, because he's parried it straight back out to me, the rebound I should have scored.
You see, I think you're ignoring your own teaching there, because there's a guy on the edge of the penalty box, Nigel Clough, who's visualising, I'm going to kick this, I'm going to stop him from, when this rebound comes out, I'm going to get in there, because he chases you like a terrier after a tennis ball.
He does,
but he gets there and he puts you off.
I think he was quite close to me, but it was still a simple chance and I shouldn't score.
You hammered yourself all your life for that one penalty. You're going to have to let this go psychologically, let me tell you from my heart.
I was more disappointed that I missed the rebound than I did actually that the penalty was saved.
I've heard you say that before, and you're taking some credit away from young Nigel. Let him have his moment. It's not about Mark Crosley, is it?
Yeah. I didn't really see him, to be honest.
Listeners, Matt is not even interested in even playing with the thought. Eh? That's what defines a winner.
There you go. The Big Interview is produced by Backpage and by me, Graham Hunter. Thanks as always to Beer Jacket for the music. Please don't only keep up to date with everything that we're doing at grahamhunter.tv, but sign up. It's free. There's a little box for your email address, and it means that you won't miss an episode. Never mind all the podcast apps that you've got. I'm Undercast, Overcast, Wombling Free, whatever it might be. Sign up with us, and we send you the podcast every time it comes out. And we tell you about little pieces of news, and we allow you to get your questions to us for the guests as we announce them. There's a newsletter. It'll keep you informed with everything that the Big Interview is doing. We're on Facebook. Look for the Big Interview. We're at GH Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. Please keep in touch. Let us know what you think. We do this for you, not just for ourselves, although, damn it, we do enjoy it. Thanks for being there. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.